A son, a father, and a prophecy. We explore what happens when a relative disappears into an alternate reality. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, March 11th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we talk with journalist Zach Mack. His father bet him $10,000 that a series of political predictions would come true in 2024. None of them did, and Zach won some money. But what he really gained was insight into the collapse of his family under the weight of conspiracy theories. Then it seems like a good time to refresh our classrooms and our routines. Today's Teacher Talk looks at what it means to rest and restore. But first, the clocks moved forward, but maybe we didn't. We welcome a sleep specialist for our annual reminder that being tired can be dangerous, along with tips for getting back on track. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, we sprung forward this weekend on our clocks, and some of us got left behind the semi-annual time change. Here to help us sort out our sleep cycles, we have Brenda Rodert. She's the Avera McKennan Sleep Lab Supervisor.
It is rough on our bodies for sure. We all have a normal circadian rhythm, and that the smart folks at the AASM, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, says that our circadian rhythm more regularly matches standard time. So when we shoot ahead, it kind of messes up all of our natural wake and sleep hygiene things. It makes it off. There's lots of things that we can do before the time changes to kind of ease that a little bit. But after the time changes, we just kind of have to get through it.
Yeah, we did none of those things.
Nope, me neither. And I know better.
We did none of the things to get ourselves ready for this moment. We should have talked to you 2 weeks ago. We did not. We're sorry. So what do we do now? Where do we start?
Now you just start making up the difference a little bit, even if that is going to bed just about a half hour earlier and waking up a half hour earlier and trying to adjust and try adjusting your schedule that way, not just cold turkey and earlier and later and all that stuff. But if you can kind of ease yourself into it and kind of keep your 7 hours a night ballpark in mind when you're trying to go to bed a little earlier, it helps a little bit.
What about for children?
Children is even tougher. Can you imagine having to figure it out when you're a little kid and don't understand what's really going on? Same things. And for us grownups is showing them a little grace. Get them to bed a little earlier. Get them up a little earlier. Try adjusting that schedule a little bit. Even with routines, do your bath a little earlier. If you can eat supper at a little earlier, that all helps too.
So how long, if we do these things, if we do the right things, how long before we start to adjust to the new normal?
It still takes a couple weeks to get all that sunshine and vitamin D and melatonin and all that stuff working the way it's supposed to.
And if we don't do, if we just, you know, don't practice good sleep hygiene and we kind of just let it ride because it's all going to work out, does it take longer? Or are we still?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
yes, it does take longer just because that bad sleep hygiene kind of floats over into all the other parts of your life, which makes things that much more difficult.
Yeah. Talk more about that because there's a so what here, you know, but
yeah,
it can be dangerous and it can be unhealthy. What are some of the problems you see?
It can be. Sometimes just that hour's difference makes you a little more groggy in the morning. You're more apt to have accidents. You're more apt to make mistakes at work in that first couple hours of the day as you're getting used to things. It also, with that circadian rhythm being kind of messed up a little bit, your chances of strokes and stuff start to increase if you can't get your sleep schedule back online.
All right, so let's talk about when we need help. When do we need to come see you? When do we talk to our primary care provider about sleep just not working out in our lives?
If you are having a pretty good routine, if you're going to bed at about the same time, if you're getting up at about the same time, if you are still just not rested in the morning and kind of just feeling groggy and kind of crappy all day long, If your sleep partner is elbowing you during the night and asking you to roll over, sometimes those are signs that maybe you should see your sleep doctor.
All right. So I go to the doctor and they refer me to a sleep lab. What kinds of tests and questions and screenings might someone be looking forward to? People are nervous about that. Help them walk through.
Yeah, people are nervous about it. Sometimes there's a screening when you go to your primary care doctor that's called an Epworth Sleepiness Scale. And they'll ask you, do you snore? Are you tired when you're driving? Are you tired after you eat? Some of those screenings happen before you get to me. We have a couple different kinds of options for sleep testing. You could do a home sleep test, is where you'll come and talk to me for about 15 minutes and get a piece of equipment to take home and wear a night and bring it back to us, and we download it. There's also the in-lab studies, which is a little more things to do. There's more wires and all that stuff. That's when you come into the lab and we hook you all up with our wires and we watch your brain waves when you sleep all night to determine sleep and wake. So those are our two options for sleep testing here at McKinnon.
For the people who have more serious problems, the things that are not going to settle down after a 2 or 3 week adjustment after daylight savings time, what's the benefit of getting the help that you need?
Man, your body is a fine-tuned machine. So if you are not sleeping well, you're probably not breathing well. You're probably not oxygenating well. So then that makes your kidneys work a little harder. It makes your heart work a little harder. It makes it harder to lose weight and concentrate on things. So if you can kind of get your sleep straightened out a little bit, you're less likely to have a stroke, to have diabetes, that kind of stuff. Not saying that fixing your sleep is going to fix all those other problems, but if you get your sleep fixed, then it doesn't accelerate those other problems or make them worse either.
Yeah. What's the role of taking a good nap? Do it or don't do it?
If you need it, do it. If it is a routine thing that you have to do every single day to function, then maybe you should talk to your doctor about it.
That's Avera McKinnon Sleep Lab Supervisor Brenda Rodert, helping us all get back on track as the time has changed. We'll take a break. When we come back, we get back on track with courageous conversations, and we'll hear from a journalist whose father bet him $10,000 that martial law would take over the United States in 2024. He lost the bet, but father and son won insight into each other's lives. And later in the hour, we take a little classroom refresh that's good for all of us on Teacher Talk. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Another courageous conversation is happening in South Dakota. This time, the bipartisan civil discourse is tackling immigration and amnesty. People from both sides of the political divide will explore what comprehensive immigration reform could look like. Now, on Thursday, we'll bring you a conversation about that upcoming event. But first, let's listen back to another courageous conversation discussion for context. Moderators Joel Allen and Jeff Pospisil set the stage for us about the program last year. We'll begin with Pospisil sharing why he says the courageous conversations are much more than debates.
A lot of our culture, we're used to watching people debate and fight. We've seen the presidential debates. We've seen other debates, maybe on YouTube or on the screen. And then when it's our turn to engage in the debate, we don't feel qualified. So I hear time and time again how people will come up afterwards and say, you know, I really agreed with this. I really, you know, or I disagreed with this. And it just doesn't happen in the public because, and again, I think a lot of times we just don't feel qualified. We haven't prepared enough. We haven't practiced. And this is a way to say, everybody's welcome to the conversation. Everybody's welcome to participate, share your ideas and experiences. You don't have to be polished. Mm-hmm. That's the more important thing is, can we engage together and not just be on the sidelines when we're talking about controversial issues?
We don't have to be polished. Do we have to be informed? Like, how does that impact, like, when you come to the conversation? And I want to stick with you, Jeff, for a minute, because I think what you said is really important there. Like, I'm finding in my life a lot of people are coming to a conversation after they feel like they are armed with the right information And often that's information that, you know, reflects what they already believe so that they can be more polished. But what I'm trying to convince them is to come, you know, more open to, you know, to listening and to sharing how they feel, not just what they found online. Help, you know, so say more about that, because I think that's super interesting place to begin.
Because our concern is not necessarily about being right or the winner necessarily on any issue, but it is really to bring your personal experiences. Because even as we were listening to your last segment, I was thinking, okay, my grandma was married at a young age, and so was my stepmother. Are there exceptions? And it was just even trying to be able to debate that from my personal experiences. And this is the first time I had to think about the issue. Yeah. And I think at least those experiences would have been valid. What good does it do to the whole conversation if I just keep them to myself?
Right. So yeah. Joel, jump in here and let's talk more about the sort of the personal experiences and the idea of being qualified to come and have the conversation.
Well, it's interesting. I was actually in that State Affairs Committee meeting when they had the debate on the marriageability age. Yeah. And it's funny, even in this conversation, because I can tell from what Jeff said that I would disagree with him on this topic. I'm very much for increasing the marriageability age to 18. So it's just really been fun for Jeff and I, because we, even before we became Braver Angels partners and moderators, we did some other podcasting on biblical studies, actually. Mm. And so we've had this kind of red-blue kind of set of conversations in the past. But Braver Angels really is committed to, at every level of organization, to have people on both sides of the coin. So we're going to be going to the convention this summer, and we're going to bring some students, and one of them is red, one of them is blue, and they have to register together as a team and be accepted together as a team. So it's a very central to what this kind of pursuit after the truth is all about. And Jeff is the one that came up with the idea of changing the name to Courageous Conversations, which I loved. I think that's a good description of what these Braver Angels discussions are all about.
Okay, so here's a big question that I'm wondering, and you both can address this, but we'll start with Joel's voice and then invite Jeff in this time. It's not about winning, even though we all have this temptation to, you know, be validated or heard or and even win, like get the zinger in. You know, like sometimes we're drawn to that in spite of ourselves, in spite of, you know, maybe wanting to be patient. So a big question would be, are you trying to win in the center and be stronger voices than something that might be more fringe on the left or fringe on the right? Are we gathering together with the goal? See where I'm going there? Joel, start with that, because that's one of the big questions here. Is this a conversation for people who are moderates?
Yeah, that's a good question. Although we've seen in the past when we've done these, there have been people that are very strong, and not only strong, but I mean, moderates can be strong in their opinion too, but very extreme. And I haven't yet seen a circumstance where that boiled or it devolved into name calling and that type of thing. We've really seen the way these debates are structured. At the beginning of every debate, you kind of rehearse the values of that debate. So the value is, we are not here to win. We are here as a community pursuit for the truth, and that's what our value is. And then hearing a position from one side and then to the other, And the way it's structured, where the people asking questions don't ask the question directly to the person that's speaking, the previous speaker, but they ask the question to the debate moderator. It just kind of, it's like a pressure valve release. Mm-hmm. And it really is a model, the Braver Angels model, which we're, you know, calling these Courageous Conversations, under the Braver Angels protocol, they work. They really do work. And we've had some really exciting success, especially with the debate we did last time on the lake, Lake Hamish, very contentious topic, $25 million project. And so.
What would you add to that, Jeff? Yeah.
I wouldn't say that it moves people towards the center. I want to say it humanizes both sides, is what I would say. When you hear somebody, for example, we had a red-blue conversation where you pair up, that was one of our events, where you pair up somebody that's red with somebody that's blue, somebody that's conservative with somebody that's liberal, And you kind of went through the life story. How did you come to your beliefs or your political positions? And again, it makes the person not just in my case, I'm the red one, so it makes them not a stereotypical liberal. They are a real person that grew up in South Dakota and just has different positions from me. And you can find places where you can connect, but I do think that's one of the main things, is it humanizes, and it also, I think it fleshes out the other side of the argument. You might know from your own experience why you believe certain things, but you may not understand how could somebody believe differently from you. All of a sudden that gives them the opportunity. Yeah. So part of when we say courageous conversations, it's not just getting up and talking at the mic, but yeah, it's also being courageous enough to listen, mm-hmm, and to really try to hear what the other people are saying.
Yeah, that's a great description.
Yeah. So this idea, you know, we talk about the community pursuit for the truth and mm-hmm, personal experience and lived experience and humanizing other people. Then I feel like it's important to also bring up this idea of data and, you know, beyond the personal story, beyond the anecdote, like what's really happening broadly, because you might have an experience that is an outlier from right, what's really happening, and that also needs to be maintained when you're searching for community truth. So Jeff, you start with that one, in data versus anecdote. What does that bring up for you?
Oh, and I'm an accountant by trade, and I love data. I mean, and so for me, that's the hard part, where I know you're not supposed to bring in statistics, and you're not supposed to argue those things, because partially I know that you can find statistics to support whatever you want to believe. Right. So that is a challenge for me. I do think a lot of times what we do is when we use data and statistics, we use it like a club or a silence button, something like that. And I think that's more the intent of it. And so I don't mind people bringing in, you know, 45% of people, blah, blah, blah. And as an example, my grandmother experienced this or something like that. You know, that's a way to at least personalize it and not just be... Just the bludgeon that it sometimes is, the data is.
Yeah.
One of the things we do try to discourage is for people to challenge each other's references, and, you know, to require or to, in other words, we try to keep the debate in the area of ideas and experiences, but then, if, you know, it's easy to just kind of throw away what someone says because mm-hmm, you disagree with their source. And so we try to discourage that and try to keep the conversation in the zone of what you believe and what you've experienced.
Yeah. All right. So a story can be used as a club too. I mean, a story can be used as a, but this happens, here's a crime that was committed, and that for, it means everyone in this community is, you know, capable of committing a crime. So how do you handle in the context of the Braver Angels conversations when somebody does have a really painful experience? Mm. So we'll go back to the marriage conversation we heard. You know, somebody's grandmother was married at the age of 15, and she was miserable and abused, and this terrible thing happened to her. And therefore, you know, she's bringing a very different personal experience to the conversation. Is that a matter then, Joel, of reflecting some kind of empathy? Or, like, what does the protocol say about some of those really difficult personal experiences?
I don't know if the protocol really speaks to that in that level of specificity, but I think that the fact that once you are beginning to humanize each other, those kinds of experiences can often come out, and where someone has a very specific experience. And I think that where that kind of falls out is it just helps us to increasingly humanize the person. In other words, if I'm sitting here thinking, how in the world could a person believe or think what you think? And then you hear a story of theirs that where it allows you to say, oh, well, now I can understand why you think that. I think your story is, you know, it's an exception that may prove the rule, but there may be reason to not agree with it, even though it was a very powerful meeting in terms of like setting some policy based on a person's experience. Yeah. But it can help us to humanize each other, and so that's, I think, the part that personal experiences like that can play.
Jeff, I'm wondering if you might leave us with, for people who are, you know, they're interested in coming to the conversation, maybe they're going to sign up, but they like just the idea of what you're talking about. Is there a question that you would bring to, you know, dinner with friends when a controversial issue sort of raises its head, that would be a good way to, you know, set a tone?
You know, when I think about this, because and I'm not the best person to do this, when I'm at the dinner table with my wife, we tend to go to data and we go to Google and say that's going to answer our question. So
that's why I'm asking you, because
because I've made this mistake a number of times. So I would say the better question to ask is, so why do you believe that? And just to even to be able to listen to them and maybe ask some follow-up questions, you know, that I think would start it out better than you're not accusing them. You're not saying, why do you believe that? You're saying, why do you believe that? And just engage, start that conversation there. Probably, I think we're emotional creatures. I think that's why we talk about stories, because a lot of us, we're not really data-driven if we look back at it. We use data to validate our opinions, not necessarily to form our opinions. So if you start diving into the why do you believe that and get the story behind it, that would be probably the most helpful thing.
All right. We'll start with why do you believe that, Joel Allen and Jeff Pospisil. Thank you so much for being here with us. It's just a delight.
Thank you, Lori. This has been a lot of fun.
That's Joel Allen and Jeff Pospisil. Join me this Thursday for a preview of the next Courageous Conversation event. The topic, immigration and amnesty. That's on March 17th in Sioux Falls. On New Year's Day 2025, journalist Zach Mack won $10,000, and it was a sign that his family was being torn apart. Mack's father had fallen down a rabbit hole of conspiracy theories online. He had a list of 10 things he thought would happen for sure in 2024. Top Democrats would be charged and imprisoned. Martial law would be instituted nationwide. Donald Trump would gain the presidency without the need for a November election. So he bet his son $1,000 each that his 10 predictions would come true. The father lost, but all that did was convince him that he'd gotten the timeline a little bit wrong. Zach Mack is host of Alternate Realities. It's a series from NPR's Embedded podcast on losing family members to conspiracies. I connected with him over Zoom.
This all started about a year ago when my father called and left me this message.
Hey, Zach, Dad again. Good conversation last night. Hey, I didn't remember to tell you this because I was kind of tired, but they're going to shut us down again, and it's going to be a worse shutdown than 2020 because of this EMP. All the supply lines are going to be disrupted. So you really want to store up 2 months worth of food and water, because they probably won't be able to pump water throughout the city because that's all controlled by computers and electronics. And the EMP is going to shut down everything electronic. I know it sounds like conspiracy theory, but they're going to do this. This is what they're planning, and I just want to have you be prepared, okay?
This show and this bet sort of all came about because my father and I were just trapped in having these circular arguments that were going nowhere. You know, he was talking about a lot of his conspiratorial beliefs. I was saying, hey, Dad, these are not based in reality. These days, we can barely get through a family dinner without him saying something that fast-tracks us into debate, usually while my mom and sister look the other way.
You're saying that I'm a conspiracy theorist.
Yes.
And the facts that I'm citing are totally bogus, according to your opinion.
Well, yes. Right? One of the last times I was home, we got into it because Dad was complaining about YouTube removing a lot of the stuff he wants to watch.
It's called denying us freedom of speech.
No.
It's called denying us freedom of speech.
It's misinformation.
No. Who gets the right to label it misinformation?
He wouldn't believe me, and you know, at some point he challenged me to a bet. You know, it's a very, I feel like it's a very guy thing to do when you're arguing and it's going nowhere. At some point there becomes a bet or like a boxing match, right?
And you know, in some ways, because you're in touch with reality, that you're going to win, but you're not really sure if he's going to change the rules. So how did you come to this series of conversations saying, like, I'm getting certain things on tape, I'm watching things unfold? How did you come with an openness?
Yeah, I mean, when he proposed the bet, I took a look at the questions, or I took a look at the predictions, and yeah, I thought these will most likely not happen.
Number one, Obama will be found guilty of treason in 2024.
So, like, by a court?
Yes.
Okay. Not the court of public opinion.
Correct.
Okay. And then number two?
Biden will be found guilty of treason in 2024.
Just treason for something specific?
For selling all those secrets that he had in the back of his Corvette.
Okay. I don't know if that's a joke. I'm not sure.
It's partially a joke, but it's also real.
Okay.
And if they do happen, I will be quite surprised and will be a lot more open to hearing his ideas. But the ultimate goal was to sort of wait him out over the course of the year, knowing, okay, in a year, he will be proven wrong, which he was, and then maybe he would be more willing to sort of come to the table. So I just took it as an opportunity because he was just putting it all out there, and I knew there would be a measurable who's right and who's wrong at the end of the year. So I figured it would be easier for us to start from that place. But so when he did that, I just proposed that throughout the year we check in on the bed and just continue to check in over the phone, and that I would record things. He was very enthusiastic about the idea, and it allowed us to sort of put our arguments on hold for a year and just, you know, assume neither of us were right or wrong, and we could just have conversations throughout the year about his beliefs and how he got there, and I could sort of start to understand him a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. Had you listened to him before? Because he wasn't always like this.
This is sort of new, yeah.
Yeah. How much did COVID change the way that he was expressing to you thoughts that were conspiratorial?
A lot. I think so much of this happened during COVID. You know, before he's very religious and increasingly Christian conservative. Like his religious views are sort of growing and growing. He was becoming more and more conservative. Before COVID, he was starting to dabble in conspiracies. I remember one time he and I got into an argument because he was trying to tell me that Mark Zuckerberg didn't really create Facebook and that he was sort of a government pawn. But, you know, so there were sort of weird things here and there. But when COVID came around, they got a lot weirder and a lot more frequent. And I really think, like so many people, that is when he got radicalized.
Yeah. And it's not just what he says and what he believes. It's also his behavior. And I think that's important because your mother says, you know, he's taking money that we haven't agreed to spend, and he's putting it in, survivalists, you know, buying two generators and moving cash into precious metals or, you know, some other form of, you know, trying to save the money. So it's not just that he's walking around saying he believes something. It's that his beliefs are hurting people, your sister, for example, because he does not accept her, and your mother, because there's a real undercurrent of instability that has now entered their marriage. Where did you draw the line between the, hey, it's okay if dad believes something, and hey, it's about more than just what he's doing. It's also this thing that he believes is really, really important. I can't look away from this thing that he believes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a tough line to draw, and I think that line is different for everyone. But, you know, for my mom, she drew one line. My sister has a different line. You know, I think my mom felt like she couldn't trust him. And, you know, I think it's hard to share a household with someone who you don't share a reality with. But for me, you know, It's tough. I work in journalism. I work all day long. I'm sort of around things that have to be fact checked and vetted, and you know, everything is so thorough. And I would just hear my father spout off, you know, nonsense that was not based in reality, and that's sort of very triggering for me. And so I would have these conversations with him, and lob facts at him, and that wouldn't work. That went nowhere. It's tough, but the goal is, it's not that I have an issue with him having different beliefs. It's that his beliefs are not grounded in reality and are provably false, right? Oftentimes.
Right. One of the things I think is so powerful is this part where you're talking to, you know, some specialists about, you know, what's going on in somebody's mind. And you hear your father again and again saying, like, well, the three of you aren't listening to me. The three of you.
Right.
All three of you are judging me very harshly. And that's what's causing the rift. I can accept you and love you and have my beliefs and accept your beliefs. You can't accept my beliefs without judging me.
It's very important to him, it seems to me, as an audience member, that he feels like an outsider in his own family, and that the three of you are not accepting him, but you're asking him to accept you. But your right. point back to him is, well, the thing that you're believing in is not actually real, and we can prove it. Yeah. How much do you think is, you know, as a father, how much do you think was driven by his desire to be relevant and influential in your life?
I'm sure that some of these ideas, like that is an appeal for him. You know, my father has been an outsider in the family for so long. He is the lone Christian conservative. My mom is Jewish. My sister and I are not really religious. We also grew up in the Bay Area, you know, a very liberal place, a not particularly Christian or religious place. So he's often the outsider in social circles. And I do think that has been very isolating for him. And one of the things I've learned about conspiracy theories and some of the appeal is when you are sort of lower in status in certain social groups, you look for ways to elevate your status. And one of those ways to do it is to have access to special knowledge, access to knowledge that not everybody knows about. And, you know, I think for him, it's knowledge that isn't real, but it's still effective anyway.
Yeah. And many people are going to relate to that. I saw it on this news channel, but your dad is actually saying, I have access to information that you don't have because I have a connection
right.
to the spiritual world
right.
and to prophets and prophecies. So it's another layer to this. Another really powerful moment, Zach, which is, you know, that pull over on the South Dakota interstate and park at a rest stop for a few minutes moment so I could grab, you know, collect myself, is just the grief that you express.
As the conversation wound down, I let go of any notion I could convince him of anything he didn't already believe. I was finally ready to stop struggling and just accept the truth. I couldn't help him. Maybe someone else could.
If I arranged for someone to speak with you about this stuff who sort of specializes in this stuff, would you be open to something like that?
Sure.
Yeah? You actually would?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, honestly, that's kind of it. I just want to say I do really appreciate. Oh, man, sorry. It's been a hard year, man. I mean, I appreciate the conversations we've had all year. Like, I feel closer to you than I ever have, and I'm really sad about the state of this family.
That I think so many of us can relate to, and you're doing this on our behalf, that we have lost someone. But here they are right here saying all the things, saying, I love you, I want to be in a relationship with you. But yet there's a big piece of grief here for you and your family. Would you speak to that, please?
Yeah, I think, you know, it is devastating to see your family being sort of torn apart by insidious ideas that have just really taken hold. And I knew that my story was not unique, that this is happening all over the country, in households all over the country. In just the week since putting out this story, I have heard from literal hundreds of people who are going through something similar, and that felt like this story really, really touched them and resonated with them. This is, yeah, this is not unique, and it's happening all over, and I do feel like there's like a real war on truth happening, and we just have to fight for it.
Yeah. Everybody, we just have about a minute left, but everybody will make their own decisions and their own families about what they're willing to accept and how they're going to proceed. What are some of the guidelines that you will take forward in how you will form a relationship with your father now that this project is wrapped?
Yeah, you know, I still have hope that he'll come around. He challenged me to another bet this year. I'm a little less interested in making a whole other podcast about that, and more so just using it as a way to continue to talk to him and continue to hold his beliefs accountable. You know, if he misses on all 10 again, and then all of a sudden we look and he's 0 for 20 on these predictions, you know, at some point I'm hoping he sort of starts to snap out of it and we can pull him back to reality. So I haven't totally lost hope, but it's really challenging to get someone out of the rabbit hole once they've fallen down.
Is that worth your time?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm going to spend significantly less time on it this year. I think this year was very difficult making this project. Like, it was very difficult emotionally making this project. So I'm not at all interested in going through what I went through this past year, but you know, we can check in a few times.
That's Zach Mack, host of Alternate Realities. It's a series on NPR's Embedded podcast. Find Embedded on your favorite podcast platform. Up next, we will hit the reset button with SDPB's Teacher Talk. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Pausing to recharge is important to avoid burnout, especially in the teaching profession. And this seems like a good week to refocus on recharging. Let's listen back to a Teacher Talk conversation about recharging. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center for Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota School of Education. She began her career in public schools in 2007 and has served as a middle and high school teacher and public librarian. She is an experienced registered yoga teacher through Yoga Alliance. Gina Benz is in her 25th year of teaching. She teaches Teacher Pathway and AP English Language at Roosevelt High School in Sioux Falls. She's also on the adjunct faculty at several colleges and universities. She is the recipient of the prestigious Milken Educator Award.
You know, the first thing I usually do on a break is I crash, and I usually need several days just to sleep, rest. And I don't know if this is true for all English teachers, but I cannot read one thing. I cannot write one thing. Do not put words in front of me. Just let me crash. Maybe I'll listen to a podcast.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And you say this in the blog post that you said, is that you get to do these things at your own pace in your own time. So and I feel this way too. I always tell people I love everything about my job. I just don't love doing it as fast as sometimes I really just have to do it with the pace of daily news. But there's nothing I dislike. So sometimes when I take work home, that is the great luxury, because you can spend the time that you know it deserves.
And you have such deadlines in your profession. Yeah. But I do like, I said in the companion blog, I like to be able to do the work I need to do. And I did. You know, I had to read some student writing and give them feedback, write a letter of recommendation, emails, all those things. But I got to do it in my pajamas, at my own pace, with a not just a cup of coffee, but an actually hot cup of coffee with me the whole time. And so I try to focus on those positive parts of doing that work at home.
Jackie, I want to ask what you did over the break. But first, the line between taking work home and having it be self-care, because you're getting caught up on a few things and you're reconnecting with your love of the work itself. That's one of the things that I if I slow down and do something at home on my own time, often that is a way for me to just remind myself how much I love my job. And so it can be an act of self-care. Mm-hmm. Also, the pressure's off and you're like, ooh, I'm caught up. I can go back to work and smile at people instead of having my nose down. But when is it too much where you're just like, you never walked away from, you know, you come back and you're like, what did you do? I worked and there was no bottom to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think?
No, I'm completely with you that setting that space to take a break is so important. Actually, the U.S. Department of Education posts something on LinkedIn about this very topic. So I was excited to see. I think everyone's kind of feeling this need to make sure that we don't just spring right back into this second semester here full speed and give ourselves a little bit of time to take that pause that we all hopefully had over winter break. And so all of Gina's lists of rest, relationship, and recreation are on there, but also focusing on positivity, making sure to eat healthy, getting regular exercise, and then also setting those goals and priorities. So I think for me that always comes back, those priorities of core values. You know, yes, I did work over break too, but only the things that were priority for me in terms of my core values, because the rest of my work life picks back up this week when I'm back in the office. But during the time that I was actually off, I tried to only work on the things that felt nourishing and fun to work on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gina, rest, relationships, and recreation of winter break, which you were able to experience and delight in, you want to make those constants in your life. I think this is a different take on a resolution that is less resolution based and more like, what is a life worth living? What is a career worth having? How do I want to navigate my days? And then using the break, which happens to be New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, to say it's time to refocus on what matters. That feels healthier than a resolution.
I agree. I saw a quote a friend sent me that said, let's not burst into 2024 with all these big ambitions and goals. Instead, let's just gently walk into 2024 with some intention. And I think that's where my mind is at right now. I do believe that the good that I felt during break, I can extend into my work time, but I have to be intentional about it. And I have to have boundaries, and I have to trust that if I take care of myself, actually the work will even become easier. And here's why, because students tend to reflect whatever we're giving off. And so if I feel rested, I feel wholehearted, let's say, to use Brené Brown's words, then I get that back from my students and the work is easier and better.
Students need that too.
Yeah.
Students need, I'm not gonna be naive, Jackie, and say that students are getting 8 hours of rest. Like I'm not silly. However, they need rest, they need recreation, they need relationships too. Jackie, how do you as a teacher create that space for students beyond setting the example in your own life, which is vital?
Yes, I do think it is vital. Like Gina said, so many students reflect like what we're doing, and we are role models as educators. And so walking the walk and not just talking the talk is an incredibly important piece. But then I also think when I was setting up my course for this semester, and I teach in the graduate program, so it's different than when I was teaching in K-12. But even then, I was being mindful of these are people who are full-time teachers who are also getting their master's degrees. What is reasonable and what is a cadence and a timeline that feels like they'll still be able to have a full life, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm really mindful, and I was when I taught in the K-12 setting too, about how much work I'm putting on them. And then I take the feedback from what students say. I might think something won't take very long, and then I find out that it did, you know? And so then you can adjust your assignments and your expectations as the semester unfolds to meet the feedback that the students are giving you. But I think it's really important to prioritize this. And I, like I said, I was really grateful that the Department of Education is saying so too. I think 2024 is a year where we're all intentionally saying work-life balance is real. And especially in the education profession, we're going to prioritize having a full, whole life for ourselves, for our students, and for those students' parents and guardians.
Yeah. Rest and sleep comes first. Let's talk about relationships, Gina, because you say you got to have friends who aren't teachers
I know we haven't talked about this.
No,
we've
haven't.
Talked so much about how precious the teacher friendships yeah. are. And honestly, it was an epiphany I had over this break when I had a 3-hour long coffee with my friend Rachel, and she is not a teacher, and we never once talked about school. And that was good with me. I wasn't upset she didn't ask me about my job. I was relieved that we could just yeah. talk about family and the other things that are important to us.
Yeah. Gina, Jackie, I have a hard time with that sometimes, just because you have to sit in the pause of if you're intentional about not talking about work, even if you're with a colleague, like, hey, we're going to talk, but we're not going to talk about work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to say, what the heck else are you going to talk about? So I've had a couple conversations over break. Here's my dirty little secret that I like prepped for
yeah.
as if I was prepping for the show, because I just wanted to be a good conversational partner to someone, and I wanted to not fall into the things that we normally just return to again and again.
Oh, I've done that.
Yeah,
I get it.
It's okay to prep for a conversation now and then.
I think so.
Absolutely.
What do you think, Jackie?
Absolutely.
No,
that's absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I used to teach speech and debate, and so one of the elements of the speech class I taught was being a good conversationalist. And yeah. so I had activities all the time, and students would prepare for these times. We would play different games, or they would be in different groups. It sort of mimicked, you know, any kind of social gathering, and they had to be able to talk about things that weren't just the weather, or, you know, they had yeah. to really work on it. And we would prep for those conversations. So you are not alone, and it's a skill that is definitely taught, but also very mentally relieving to be able to talk to folks about things other than work. And like Gina, I got to see some friends over break, and none of them are teachers. And it was so nice to just talk about other things and remember that I had other interesting things to talk about besides my career.
Yeah. I'm an interesting person outside.
Right.
Outside of my job.
Which we
and so
forget.
Are my friends.
We forget. We forget mm-hmm. that we're interesting people outside of work.
Yeah. And, you know, yeah. I also had a 3-hour coffee with 2 teacher friends.
Yeah.
And I guess you could say I set a boundary. I said, we can talk about school, but can we not talk about it the whole time? Like, is just yeah. 15 minutes okay? And yeah. they were, yes, absolutely,
hit
100%.
The highlights. Mm-hmm. And then finally, in our last 30 seconds, play and creative activities, draw, mm-hmm. paint, sing, dance.
Yeah, I work
make
with
a
my
joyful
plants.
Noise. Oh, plants.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
My plants need you.
Oh, I would love to be their foster mom.
I in quotation, air quotes, worked with my plants, and yeah, they need someone perhaps more skilled than I am. You can find this episode and more on SDPB's Teacher Talk. It's a podcast that celebrates teachers and education in South Dakota. And of course, more often than not, those lessons in the classroom turn out to be good lessons for all of us. You can find SDPB's Teacher Talk on your favorite podcast platform. Find the companion blogs on our website, sdpb.org/teachertalk. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to look back at the 2025 legislative session that was, the business that is left on the table, and some of the big themes for this legislative session. We have Lieutenant Governor Tony Venhuizen with us, also with us SDPB CJ Keene and Lee Stribinger, and of course our Dakota political junkies, Mike Card and John Hunter, join us. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.